Axel added. Should I be worried? Yes. The simplicity of the answer brought yet another grin to Jarlaxle's coal-black face. Chapter 17 Canthin's Confirmation. The door opened into a circular room that encompassed the whole of one floor of the keep. A basalt altar stood out from the northern edge of the room directly across from them. Red veins shot through the rock, accentuating the decorated covering of bas-relief images of dragons. Behind the altar, between a pair of burning braziers, sat a huge egg, large enough for a man in Treri's size to curl up inside it. "This looks like a place for fighting," Athrogate muttered, and he didn't seem the least dismayed by that probability. Given the scene outside with the undead, the dwarf's words rang true, for all around the room, set equidistant to each other, stood sarcophagi of polished stone and decorated gold. The facings of the ornate caskets indicated a standing humanoid creature, arms in tight to its sides with long feet and a long canine snout. "Knolls?" Jarlaxle asked. Behind him, Entreri secured the door, expertly resetting the lock. "Let us not tarry to find out," said Maria Brone, indicating the one other exit in the room, another descending stairwell over to their right. It was bordered by a waist-high railing, with the entry all the way on the other side of the room. The ranger, his eyes locked on the nearest sarcophagus, one hand ready on his sheathed sword, stepped out toward the center of the room. He felt a rumble, as if from a movement within that nearest sarcophagus, and he started to call out. But they didn't need the warning, for they all felt it, and Entreri broke into motion, darting past the others to the railing. He grabbed onto it and rolled right over, dropping nimbly to the stairs below. Hardly slowing, he was at the second door in an instant, working his fingers around its edges, his eyes darting all about. He took a deep breath. Though he saw no traps, the assassin knew he should inspect the door in greater detail, but he simply didn't have the time. Behind him he heard his friends scrambling on the stairs, followed by the creaking sounds as the undead monsters within the sarcophagi pushed open their coffins. He went for the lock. But before he could begin, the door popped open. Entreri fell back, drawing his weapons. Nothing came through, though, and the assassin calmed when he noted a smug-looking Canthin on the stairs behind him. "Magic spell of opening?" Entreri asked.
"We haven't the time for your inspection," replied the mage. "I thought it prudent."
"Of course you did, so long as I was close enough to catch the brunt of any traps or monsters lying in wait," Entreri thought but did not say, though his expression certainly told the others the gist of it. "They're coming out," Commander Ellery warned from up in the room. "Mummified gnolls," Jarlaxle said. "Interesting." Entreri was not so interested and had no desire to see the strange creatures. He spun away from Canthin, drawing his weapons as he went, and charged through the door. He was surprised, as were all the others as they came through, to find that he was not on the keep's lowest level. From the outside, the structure hadn't seemed tall enough to hold three stories, but sure enough, Entreri found himself on a balcony that ran around the circumference of the keep, opening to a sweeping stone stair on the northernmost wall. Moving to the waist-high iron railing, its balusters shaped to resemble twisting dragons with wings spread wide, Entreri figured out the puzzle. For the floor level below him was partially below ground, the circular section of it at least. On the southernmost side of that bottom floor, a short set of stairs led up to a rectangular alcove that held the tower's main doors, so that the profile of that lowest level reminded the assassin of a keyhole, but one snubbed short. And there, just at the top of those stairs, set in the rectangular alcove opposite the doors, sat the Book of Zhenyi, the Tome of Creation, suspended on tendrils that looked all too familiar to Artemis Entreri. The assassin eventually pulled his eyes away from the enticing target and completed a scan of the floor below. He heard the door behind him close, followed immediately by some heavy pounding and Jarlaxle saying, with his typical penchant for understatement, "We should move quickly." But Entreri wasn't in any hurry to go down the stairs or over the railing. He noted a pair of iron statues set east and west in the room below, and vividly recalled his encounter in Herminical's tower. Even worse than the possibility of a pair of iron golems, the room below was not sealed, for every few feet around the perimeter presented an opening to a tunnel of worked and fitted stones, burrowing down into the ground. Might the horde of undead be approaching through those routes even then? A sharp ring behind him turned Entreri around. Athrogate stood at the closed iron door, the locking bar and supports already rattling from the pounding of the mummified gnolls. The dwarf methodically went to work, dropping his backpack to the ground and fishing out one piton after another. He set them strategically around the door and drove them deep into the stone with a single crack of his morning star, the one enchanted with oil of impact. A moment later he hopped back and dropped his hands on his hips, surveying his work.
"Yeah, it'll hold them back for a bit."
"They're the least of our worries," Entreri said. By that point, several of the others were at the rail, looking over the room and coming up with the same grim assessment as had Entreri. Not so for Arrayan and Olgercon, though. The woman slumped against the back wall, as if merely being there, in such close proximity to the magical book, was rendering her helpless. Her larger partner didn't seem much better off.
"There are our answers," Canthan said, nodding toward the book. "Get me to it."
"Those statues will likely animate," Jarlaxle said. "Iron golems are no easy foe." Athrogate roared with laughter as he walked up beside the drow.
"Ain't ye seen nothing yet from Cracker and Whacker?"
As he named the weapons, he presented them before the dark elf. "Cracker and Whacker," the drow replied. Athrogate guffawed again as he glanced over the railing, looking down directly atop one of the iron statues.
"Meet ye below," he called,
and with that he whispered to each of his weapons, bidding them to pour forth their enchanted fluids. With another wild laugh, he hopped up atop the railing and dropped. "Cracker and Whacker?" Jarlaxle asked again. "He used to call them Rotter and Slaughter," Ellery replied, and Entreri noted that for the first time since he had met Jarlaxle, the drow seemed to have no answer whatsoever. But as there was no denying Athrogate's inanity, nor was there any way to deny his effectiveness, he landed in a sitting position on the statue's iron shoulders, his legs wrapping around its head. The golem began to animate, as predicted, but before it could even reach up at the dwarf, Cracker slapped down atop its head. The black iron of the construct skull turned reddish-brown, its integrity stolen by the secretions of a rust monster. When Whacker, gleaming with oil of impact, hit the same spot, iron dust flew and the top of the golem's head caved in. Still the creature flailed, but Athrogate had too great an advantage, whipping his weapons with precision, defeating the integrity of his opponent's natural armor with one morning star, then blasting away with the other. An iron limb went flying, and though the other hand managed to grab the dwarf and throw him hard to the floor, the tough and strong Athrogate bounced up and hit the golem with a 1-2, 1-2 combination that had one leg flying free. Then he caved in the side of its chest for good measure. But the other golem charged in, and other noises echoed from the tunnels. Mariabrone and Ellery, Pratkis in tow, charged around to the stairwell, while Entreri slipped over the railing and dropped the 15 feet to the floor, absorbing his landing with a sidelong roll. Canthan, too, went over the railing, dropping the end of a rope while its other end magically anchored in midair. He slid down off to the side of the fray with no intention of joining in. For the wizard, the goal was in sight, sitting there for the taking. He wasn't pleased when Jarlaxle floated down beside him and paced him toward the front alcove.
"Just keep them off of me," Canthan ordered the drow.
"Them?" Jarlaxle asked. Canthan wasn't listening. He paused with every step and began casting a series of spells, weaving wards around himself to fend off the defensive magic that no doubt protected the tome.
"Jarlaxle!"
Ellery cried again. The drow regarded her and shrugged.
"To me!"
she insisted. Jarlaxle glanced back at Canthan, who stood before the book, then turned his gaze back at Ellery. She meant to keep him away from it, and for no other reason than to allow Canthan to examine it first. Ellery stared at him, her look showing him in no uncertain terms that if he disobeyed her, the fight would be on. He glanced back at Canthan again and grew confident that he still had time to play things through, for the wizard was moving with great caution and seemed thoroughly perplexed. Jarlaxle started across the room toward Ellery. He paused and nodded to the stairs, where Olgercon and Arrayan were making their way down, the large half-orc practically carrying the bone-weary woman. "Secure the perimeter," Ellery instructed them all, and she waved for the half-orcs to return to the balcony. "We must give Canthan time to unravel the mystery of this place." To Maria Brown and Entreri, she added, "Scout the tunnels, to first door or 30 feet. Entreri was only peripherally listening, for he was already scanning the tunnels. All of them seemed to take the same course, a downward-sloping, 8-foot-wide corridor bending to the left after about 12 feet. Torches were set on the walls, left and right, but they were unlit. Even in the darkness, though, the skilled Entreri understood that the floors were not as solid as they appeared. "Not yet," the assassin said as Maria Brown started down one tunnel. The ranger stopped and waited as Entreri moved back from the tunnel entrance and retrieved the head of a destroyed iron golem. He moved in front of one tunnel and bade the others to back up. He rolled the head down, jumping aside as if expecting an explosion, and as he suspected, the item bounced across a pressure plate set in the floor. Fires blossomed, but not the killing flames of a fireball trap. Rather, the torches flared to life, and as the head rolled along to the bend, it hit a second pressure plate, lighting the opposing torches set there as well.
"How convenient," Ellery remarked.
"Are they all like that?" asked Maria Brown. "Pressure plates and all," Entreri replied. "What they do, I cannot tell."
"Ye just showed us, ye dolt," said Athrogate.
Entreri didn't answer, other than with a wry grin. The first rule of creating effective traps was to present a situation that put intruders at ease. He looked Athrogate over and decided he didn't need to tell the dwarf that bit of common sense. "Strange that she should choose this moment to think herself a leader," the wizard mused when he heard Ellery barking commands in the distance. To Canthan, after all, Ellery would never become more than a pawn. He could not deny her effectiveness in her present role, though. The others didn't dare go against her, particularly with the fool Maria Brown nodding and flapping his lips at her every word. A cursory glance told Canthan that Ellery was performing her responsibilities well. She had them all busy, moving tentatively down the different tunnels, with Olgercon and Arrayan back upstairs guarding the door. Pratkus anchored the arms of Ellery's scouting mission, the dwarf staying in the circular room and hopping about to regard each dark opening as Ellery, Entreri, Jarlaxle, Maria Brown, and Athrogate explored the passages. Canthan caught a glimpse of Ellery as she came out one tunnel and turned into another, her shield on one arm, axe ready in the other.
"I have taught you well," Canthan whispered under his breath.
He caught himself as he finished and silently scolded himself for allowing the distraction, any distraction, at that all-important moment. He took a deep breath and turned back to the book. His confidence grew as he read on, for he felt the empathic intrusions of the living tome and came to believe that his wards would suffice in fending them off. Quickly did the learned mage begin to decipher the ways of the book. The runes appearing in the air above it and falling into it were translations of life energy drawn from an outside source. That energy had fueled the construction, served as the living source of power animating the undead, caused the gargoyles to regenerate on their perches, and brought to life the golems. Canthan could hardly draw a breath. The sheer power of the translation overwhelmed him. For some 2 decades, the wizards of the Bloodstone Lands considered Zheng Yi's lichdom, his cheating of death itself, to be his greatest accomplishment, but the book... the book rivaled even that. The wizard devoured another page and eagerly turned to the next. In no time he had come to the point where the lettering ended, and watched in amazement as runes appeared in the air and drifted to the pages, writing as they went. The process had been vampiric at first, Canthan recognized, with the tome taking from the living force. But it had become more symbiotic, a joining of purpose and will. "The source of energy?" Canthan mused. He considered Arrayan, her weakness and that of her partner. She had found the missing book, Maria Brone and Wingham had told them. No, the wizard decided, that wasn't the whole of it. Arrayan was far more entwined in all of it than just having been drained of her life energies. Canthan smiled when he finally understood the power of the tome and knew how to defeat it. And not just defeat it, he hoped, but possess it. He tore his gaze away from the page and glanced up the staircase to see Arrayan leaning back against a wall, watching Olgercon. She looked his way desperately, plaintively. Too much so, Canthan knew. There was more at stake for the young woman than merely whether or not they could find their way out of the castle. For her, it was much more personal than the safety of Palaszczuk. Entreri had shown them how to test each pressure plate safely, but Maria Brone needed no such instructions. The ranger had played through similar scenarios many times and had the know-how and the equipment to work his way quickly down the tunnel he had chosen. It had continued to bend around to the left for many feet, with pressure plates set between wall-set torches every dozen feet or so. Maria Brone lit the first by tapping the plate with a long telescoping pole. But he did not trigger the next, or the next after that, preferring to walk in near darkness. Then, convinced all was clear, the ranger rushed back to the second set of torches and triggered the plate. He repeated the process, always lighting the torches two sets back. After about 50 feet, the tunnel became a staircase, moving straight down for many, many steps. Maria Brone glanced back the way he had come. Ellery had told them to inspect the tunnels just to 30 feet or so. The ranger had always been that advanced and independent scout, though, and he trusted his instincts. Down he went, testing the stairs and the walls. Slowly and steadily, he put 3 dozen steps behind him before it simply became too dark for him to continue. Not willing to mark his position clearly by lighting a candle or torch of his own, Maria Brone sighed and turned back. But then a light appeared below him, behind the slightly ajar door of a chamber at the bottom of the stairs. Maria Brone eyed it for a long while, the hairs on the back of his neck tingling and standing on end. Such were the moments he lived for, the precipice of disaster, the taunt of the unknown. Smiling despite himself, Maria Brone crept down to the door. He listened for a short while and dared to peek in. Every castle must have a treasure room, was his first thought, and he figured he was looking in on one of the antechambers to just that. 2 decorated sarcophagi were set against the opposite wall, framing a closed iron door. Before them, in the center of the room, a brazier burned brightly, a thin line of black smoke snaking up to the high ceiling above. Centering that ceiling was a circular depression set with some sort of bas-relief that Maria Brone could not make out, though it looked to him as if there were egg-like stones set into it. Stone tables covered in decorated silver candelabra and assorted trinkets lined the side walls, and the ranger made out some silver bells, a gem-topped scepter, and a golden censer. Religious items mostly, it seemed to him. A single cloth hung from one table, stitched with a scene of gnolls dancing around a rearing black dragon. "Lovely combination," he whispered. Maria Brone glanced back up the ascending corridor behind him. Perhaps he shouldn't press on. He could guess easily enough what those sarcophagi might hold. The ranger grinned. Such had been the story of his life, always pushing ahead farther than he should. He recalled the scolding King Gareth had given to him upon his first official scouting expedition in eastern Vasa. Gareth had bade him to map the region along the Galenas for 5 miles. Maria Brone had gone all the way to Palaszczuk. That was who he was and how he played. Always on the edge and always just skilled enough or lucky enough to sneak out of whatever trouble his adventurous character had found. So it was still, and he couldn't resist. The Honorable General Danaway of the Vasan Gate had been wise indeed not to entrust Ellery to Maria Brone's care alone. The ranger pushed open the door and slipped into the room. Gold and silver reflected in his brown eyes, gleaming in the light of the brazier. Maria Brown tried hard not to become distracted, though, and set himself in line with the coffins. As he had expected, their dog-faced, decorated lids swung open. As one gnome mummy strode forth from its coffin, Maria Brown was there, a smile on his face, his sword deftly slashing and stabbing. He hit the creature several times before it had even cleared the coffin, and when it reached for him with one arm lumbering forward, Maria Brown gladly took that arm off at the elbow. The second was on him by then, and the ranger hopped back. He went into a quick spin, coming around fast, blade level, and the enchanted sword creased the gnoll's abdominal area, tearing filthy gray bandages aside and opening up a gash across the belly of the dried-out husk of the undead creature. The gnoll mummy groaned and slowed its pursuit. Maria Brown smiled all the wider, knowing that his weapon could indeed hurt the thing. And the two undead creatures simply weren't fast enough to present a serious threat to the skilled warrior. Maria Brown's blade worked brilliantly and with lightning speed and pinpoint accuracy, finding every opening in the mummy's defenses, taking what was offered and never asking for more. He fought with no sense of urgency, as was his trademark, and it was rooted in the confidence that whatever came along, he would have the skills to defeat it. A rattle from above tested that confidence. Both mummies were ragged things by then, much more so than they had been when first they had emerged from their coffins, with rag wrappings hanging free and deep gashes oozing foul odors and the occasional drip of ichor all around them both. One had only half an arm, a gray-black bony spur protruding from the stump. The other barely moved, its gut hanging open, its legs torn. The ranger led them to the near side of the room, back to the door through which he'd entered. Then he disengaged and dashed back to find the time to glance up at the rattle. He noted one of the egg shapes rocking back and forth above the brazier. It broke free of the ceiling and dropped to the flaming bowl. Maria Brown's eyes widened with curiosity as he watched it fall. He came to realize that it was not an egg-shaped stone, but an actual egg of some sort. It hit the flaming stones in the bowl and cracked open, and a line of blacker smoke rushed out of it, widening as it rose. Hoping it was no poison, Maria Brown darted back at the mummies, thinking to slash through them and get in position for a fast exit. He hit the nearest again in the gut, extending the already deep wound so thoroughly that the creature buckled over, folded in half, and fell into a heap. The other swung at Maria Brown, but the ranger was too fast. He ducked the lumbering blow and quick-stepped past, nearly to the door.
"You shall not run!"
came a booming voice in his ears, and the ranger felt a shiver course his spine. Accompanying that voice was a sudden sharp gust of wind that whipped the ranger's cloak up over his back. Worse for Maria Brown, though, the wind slammed the door. He rolled and turned as he came around, so that he faced the room with his back to the door. His jaw dropped as he followed the billowing column of black smoke up and up to where it had formed into the torso and horned head of a gigantic, powerful demonic creature that radiated an aura of pure evil. Its head and facial features resembled that of a snub-nosed bulldog, with huge canines and a pair of inward-looking horns at the sides of its wide head. Its arms and hands seemed formed of smoke, great grasping black hands with fingers narrowing to sharp points.
"Well met, human," the demon creature said. "You came here seeking adventure and a test of your skills, no doubt. Would you leave when you have at last found it?"
"I will send you back to the abyss, demon," Maria Brown promised. He started forward, but realized his error immediately, for in his fascination with the more formidable beast, he had taken his eye off the mummy. It came forward with a lumbering swing. The ranger twisted and ducked the blow. But that second, cropped arm stabbed in, the sheared, sharpened bone gashing Maria Brown's neck. Again, Maria Brown's speed extracted him before the mummy could follow through, but he felt the warmth of his own blood dribbling down his neck. Before he could even consider that, however, he was leaping aside once more. The smoky creature blew forth a cone of fiery breath.
"Damon!" the beast corrected.
and my home is the plain of Gehenna, where I will gladly return, but not until I feast upon your bones."
Flames danced up from Mariabrone's cloak, and he spun, pulling it free as he turned. He noted then that the pursuing mummy had not been so fortunate, catching the daemon fire full force. It thrashed about, flames dancing all over it, one arm waving frantically, futilely. Mariabrone threw his cloak upon it for good measure. Then he leaped forward, and the daemon came forth, smoke forming into powerful legs as it stepped free of the brazier. It raked with its shadowy hands, and its head snapped forward to bite at Mariabrone, but again the ranger realized at once that he was the superior fighter, and that his sword could indeed inflict damage upon the otherworldly creature.
"Gehenna, then," he cried, "but you will go there hungry." "Fool, I am always hungry."
Its last word sounded more as a gurgle, as the ranger's fine sword creased its face. In his howl of triumph, though, Mariabrone didn't hear the second egg drop, or the third. Chapter 18. The Ranger's Journey. The sound of battle echoed up the corridor and into the main room of the tower. Canthan snarled at the noise, but refused to turn away from the tome. He felt certain that there were more secrets buried within that book. Energy made his skin tingle and hummed in the air around it. The book was magical, the runes were magical, and he had a much better understanding of how the castle had come about the source of energy that had facilitated the construction. But there was more. Something remained hidden just below the surface. The magical runes, even then appearing on the page, might prove to be a clue. The ring of steel distracted him. He turned back to see an agitated Practice hopping from one foot to the other in the middle of the room. Ellery came out of one tunnel and cut to the side from where the sound emanated. She looked at Practice as Athrogate emerged from a tunnel opposite. Up on the balcony, Olgercon and Aran leaned over the railing, looking down with concern.
"Who?"
Ellery asked.
"Gotta be the Ranger,"
Practice answered. Ellery ran toward the sound.
"Which tunnel?" she asked, for the torches and all had gone dark again, and the echoes of the sounds confused her.
All eyes went to the dwarf, but Practice just shrugged. Then from above, Olgercon cried out,
"Breach!"
The fight had come.
"Just keep them off me,"
Canthan growled, and he forced his attention back to the open book. Another egg fell and broke open, and that made five. Mariabrone finished the first with a two-handed overhead chop, but he was too busy leaping away from fiery daemon breath to applaud himself for the kill. He went into a frenzy, spinning, rolling, and slashing, scoring hit after hit, and he came to realize that the creatures could only breathe their fire on him from a distance. So he ran, alternately closing on each. He took a few hits and gave a few more, and his confidence only heightened when, upon hearing more rattling from above, he leaped over and shouldered the brazier to the floor. The rattling stopped. There would be no more than the four standing against him. All he had to do was hold out until his companions arrived. He sprang forward and charged, but skidded to a stop and cut to the side. He used the sarcophagi as shields and kept the clawing, smoky hands at bay. His smile appeared once more, that confidence reminiscent of a young Mariabrone who had rightly earned the nickname the Rover, and had also earned a rakish reputation with ladies all across Damara. His sense of adventure overwhelmed him. He never felt more alive, more on the edge of disaster, of freedom and doom, than he was in times of greatest danger.
"Are all of Gehenna so slow?"
he tried to say, to taunt the daemons, but halfway through the sentence he coughed up blood. The ranger froze. He brought his free hand up to his neck to feel the blood still pumping. A wave of dizziness nearly dropped him. He had to dive aside as two of the daemons loosed cones of fire at him, and so weak did he feel that he almost didn't get back to his feet. And when he did, he overbalanced so badly that he nearly staggered headlong into a third of the beasts.
"Priest, I need you," Mariabrone the Rover shouted through the blood, and all at once he wasn't so confident and exuberant. "Priest! Dwarf! I need you!"
Entreri and Jarlaxle rushed into the room to join the others.
Sounds of fighting from above assailed them, and both Entreri and Athrogate started that way. Then came the desperate call for Mariabrone.
Priest, I need you!
Athrogate, hold the balcony, Ellery ordered. The rest with me.
Entreri heard Arrayan's cry and ignored the commander's order. In his thoughts, he pictured the doom of Dwavel, his dear halfling friend, and so overwhelming was that sensation that he never paused long enough to consider it. He sprinted past the dwarf and hit the stairs running, taking them three at a time. He cut to the right, through the door, and his companions were on the balcony to the left. Then he cut back sharply to the left and leaped up to the slanted stairway railing in a dead run. His lead foot hit and started to slide, but the assassin stamped his right foot hard on the railing and leaped away, spinning as he went, so that when he lifted up near the floor of the balcony, his back was to the railing. He threw his hands up and caught the balusters, and with the others on the floor below looking up at him with mouths hanging open, Entreri's taut muscles flexed and tugged. He curled as he rose, throwing his feet up over his head. Not only was his backward flip over the railing perfectly executed, not only did he land lightly and in perfect balance, but on the way over he managed to draw both dagger and sword. He spun as he landed and threw himself into the nearest gnoll mummy, his blades working in a scything whirlwind. Gray wrappings exploded into the air, flying all around him. Down below, Jarlaxle looked to Ellery and said, "Consider the room secured." Ellery managed one quick look the drow's way as she sprinted toward the tunnel entrances. "Which one?" she asked again of Pratkis, who ran beside her.
"Yourself to the right, meself to the left,"
the dwarf replied, and they split into the two possible openings. Jarlaxle followed right behind them, but paused there. Athrogate rambled back from the stairs, trying to catch up. Torches flared to life as Ellery ran through. A split second later, Pratkis's heavy strides similarly lit the first pair in his descending corridor.
"Which one, then?"
Athrogate asked Jarlaxle.
"Here,"
Ellery cried before the drow could answer, and both Jarlaxle and Athrogate took up the chase of the warrior woman. In the other tunnel, Pratkis too heard the call, just as he passed the second set of torches which flared to life. The dwarf instinctively slowed but shook his head. Perhaps his tunnel would intersect with the other, and he wouldn't have to lose all the time backtracking, he thought, and he decided to light up one more set of torches. He hit the next pressure plate, turning sidelong so that he could quickly spin around if the light didn't reveal an intersection. But the torches didn't ignite. Instead came a sudden clanging sound, and Pratkis just happened to be looking the right way to see the iron spike slide out of the wall. He thought to throw himself aside, but only managed to cry out. The spike moved too fast. It hit him in the gut and drove him back hard against the far corridor wall. It kept going, plunging right through the dwarf and ringing hard against the stone behind him. With trembling hands, Pratkis grabbed at the stake. He tried to gather his wits, to call upon his gods for some magical healing. But the dwarf knew that he'd need more than that. Flames licked at Mariabrone from every angle. He drove his sword through a daemon's head, tore it free, and decapitated another as he swung wildly. All the room was spinning, though, and he was staggering more than charging as he went for the last pair of daemons. His consciousness flitted away. He felt the rake of claws. He lifted an arm to defend himself, and a monstrous maw clamped down upon it. Black spots became a general darkness. He felt cold, so cold. Mariabrone the Rover summoned all of his strength and went into a sudden and violent frenzy, slashing wildly, punching and kicking. Then the ranger's journey was before him, the only road he ever rightly expected while following his adventurous spirit. He was at peace. Blackness engulfed Arrayan as the mummy's strong hands closed around her throat. She couldn't begin to concentrate enough to throw one of her few remaining spells, and she knew that her magic had not the strength to defeat or even deter the monsters in any case. Nor did she have the physical strength to begin to fight back. She grabbed the mummy's wrists with her hands, but she might as well have been trying to tear an old oak tree out of the ground. She managed a glance at Olgercon, who was thrashing with another pair of the horrid creatures, and that one glance told the woman that her friend would likely join her in the netherworld. The mummy pressed harder, forcing her head back, and somewhere deep inside she hoped that her neck would just snap and be done with it before her lack of breath overcame her. Then she staggered backward, and the mummy's arms went weak in her grasp. Confused, Arayan opened her eyes, then recoiled with horror as she realized that she was holding two severed limbs. She threw them to the ground, gasped a deep and welcomed breath of air, and looked back at the creature only to see the whirlwind that was Artemis and Treri hacking it apart. Another mummy grabbed at Arayan from the side, and she cried out, and Treri was there, rolling his extraordinary sword up and over with a left-to-right backhand that forced the mummy's arms aside. The assassin turned as he followed through, flipped his dagger into the air and caught it backhand, then drove it right to the hilt into the mummy's face as he came around. Gray dust flew from the impact, and Treri yanked the dagger free, spun around so that he was facing the creature, and bulled ahead, driving it right over the railing. Arayan sobbed with horror and weakness, and the assassin grabbed her by the arm and guided her toward the stair. "Get down," he ordered. Arayan, too battered and overwhelmed, too weak and frightened, hesitated. "Go!" Treri shouted. He leaped at her, causing her to cry out again. Then he went right by, launching himself with furious abandon into another of the stubborn gnoll mummies. "Now, woman!" he shouted as his weapons began their deadly dance once more. Arayan didn't move. Treri growled in frustration. It was going to be hard enough keeping alive up there as more creatures poured in without having to protect Arayan. A glance toward the door inspired him. "Arayan," he cried, "I must get to Olgercon. To the stair with you, I beg." Perhaps it was the mention of her half-orc friend, or perhaps the calming change in his voice. But Treri was glad indeed to see the woman sprint off of the stairs. The mummy before him crumbled, and the assassin leaped ahead. Olgercon was losing badly. Bruises and cuts covered him by then, and he staggered with every lumbering swing of his heavy war club. Treri hit him full force from behind, driving him right past the pair of battling mummies, and the assassin kept pushing, throwing Olgercon hard against the back of the opened door. The door slammed, or tried to, for a gargoyle was wedged between it and the jamb. But Treri kept moving, right into the incoming creature. He ignored the mummies he knew were fast closing on him, and focused all of his fury instead on that trapped gargoyle. He slashed and stabbed and drove it back. Olgercon's weight finally closed the door. "Just hold it shut," Treri yelled at him, "for all our sakes." The assassin charged away at the remaining two mummies. Ellery instinctively knew that she was in grave danger. Perhaps it had been the tone of Maria Brone's plea for help, or even that the legendary rover had called out at all. Perhaps it was the closed door at the bottom of the staircase before her, or maybe it was the sound. For other than her footsteps and those of the duo behind her, all was silent. She lowered her shoulder and barreled through the door, stumbling into the room shield and sword presented. There she froze, then slumped in horror and despair, her fears confirmed. For there lay Maria Brone, on his back, unmoving and with his neck and chest covered in his own blood. Blood continued to roll from the neck wound, but it was not gushing forth as it had been, for the ranger's heart no longer beat.
"Too many,"
Athrogate said, rambling in behind her. "Guardian daemons," Jarlaxle remarked, noting the demonic heads, all that remained of the creatures, lying about the room. "A valiant battle." Ellery continued to simply stand there, staring at Maria Brone, staring at the dead hero of Damara. From her earliest days, Ellery had heard stories of that great man, of his work with her uncle the king, and his particular relationship with the line of Tranth, the Barons of Bloodstone, and Ellery's immediate family members. Like so many warriors of her generation, Ellery had held up the legend of Maria Brone as the epitome of a hero, the idol, and the goal. As Gareth Dragonsbane and his friends had inspired the young warriors of Maria Brone's generation, so had he passed along that inspiration to hers. and he lay dead at Ellery's feet. Dead. On a mission she was leading. Dead because of her decision to split the party to explore the tunnels. Almost unaware of her surroundings, Ellery was shaken from her turmoil by the shout of Athrogate.
"That's the priest!"
the dwarf yelled, and he charged back out of the room. Jarlaxle moved near to Ellery and put a comforting hand on her shoulder. "You are needed elsewhere," the dark elf bade her. "There is nothing more you can do here." She offered the drow a blank look. "Go with Athrogate," said Jarlaxle. "There is work to be done, and quickly." Hardly thinking, Ellery staggered out of the room. "I will see to Mariabron," Jarlaxle assured her, as she stumbled back up the corridor. True to his word, the drow was with the ranger as soon as Ellery was out of sight. He pulled out a wand and cast a quick divination spell. He was surprised and disappointed at how little magic registered on a man of Mariabron's reputation. The man's sword, Byarel, was of course enchanted, as was his armor, but none of it strongly. He wore a single magical ring, but a cursory glance told Jarlaxle that he possessed at least a dozen rings of greater enchantment. And so he shook his head and decided that pilfering the obvious ring wasn't worth the risk. One thing did catch his attention, however, and as soon as he opened Mariabron's small belt pouch, a smile widened on Jarlaxle's face. "Obsidian steed," he remarked, pulling forth the small black equine figurine. A quick inspection revealed its command words. Jarlaxle crossed the ranger's arms over his chest and placed Byarel in the appropriate position atop him. He felt a moment of regret. He had heard much of Mariabron the Rover during his short time in the Bloodstone Lands, and he knew that he had become party to a momentous event. The shock of the man's death would resonate in Vasa and Damara for a long time to come. And it occurred to Jarlaxle that it truly was an important loss. He gave a quick salute to the dead hero and acknowledged the sadness of his passing. Of course, it wasn't enough of a regret for Jarlaxle to put back the obsidian steed.
"Oh, what'd ye do?"
Athrogate asked Pratkus as soon as he came upon the dying priest. Pinned to the corridor wall, his chest shattered and torn, Pratkus could only stare numbly at his counterpart. Athrogate grabbed the spike and tried to pull it back, but he couldn't get a handhold. It wouldn't have mattered anyway, both of them knew, as did Ellery when she moved in behind the black-bearded dwarf.
"Bah! Ye go to Moradin's halls, then,"
Athrogate said. He pulled a skin from around his neck and held it up to the priest.
"A bit of the gutbuster,"
he explained, referring to that most potent of dwarven liquid spirits.
"It'll help ye get there, and put ye in a good mood for talking with the boss."
"Hurts," Pratkus gasped. He sipped at the skin, and even managed a thankful nod as the fiery liquid burned down his throat. Then he was dead. Chapter 19. Clearing the Path. Leaning on each other for much-needed support, Arrayan and Olgercon inched down the staircase. And Treri came up and moved between them, pushing Olgercon more tightly against the railing and forcing the half-orc to grab on with both his hands. And Treri turned to Arrayan, who was holding on to him and swaying unsteadily. He shifted to put his shoulder back behind her, then, in a single move, swept her up into his arms.
with a glance at Ulger Khan, to make sure that the buffoon wouldn't come tumbling behind him, the assassin started away. Arayan brought a hand up against his face, and he looked down at her, into her eyes. "You saved me," she said, her voice barely audible.
"All of us."
And Trary felt a rush of warm blood in his face. For just a brief moment, he saw the image of Dwavel's face superimposed over the similar features of Arayan. He felt warm indeed, and it occurred to him that he should just keep walking, away from the group, taking Arayan far away from all of it. His sensibilities, so entrenched and pragmatic after spending almost the entirety of his life in a desperate attempt at survival, tried to question, tried to illustrate the illogic of it all. But for the first time in 3 decades, those practical sensibilities had no voice in the thoughts of Artemis and Trary.
"Thank you,"
Arayan whispered, and her hand traced the outline of his cheek and lips. The lump in his throat was too large for Entreri to respond, other than with a quick nod.
"That'll hold, but not for long,"
Athrogate announced, coming to the railing of the balcony overlooking the keep's main floor. From below, the dwarf's 6 remaining companions glanced up at him and at the continuing pounding and scratching on the door behind him.
"More gargoyles than mummies," Athrogate explained. "Gargoyles don't hit as hard."
"The room is far from secure,"
put in Canthan, who still stood by the open book.
"They will find a way in. Let us be on our way."
"Destroy the book?"
Ulger Khan asked.
"Would that I could."
"Take it with us, then,"
Arayan asked, and the horror in her voice revealed much. Canthan snickered at her.
"Then what?"
Ellery chimed in, the first word she had spoken in some time, and with a shaky voice.
"We came here for a purpose, and that seems clear before us. Are we to run away without completing—"
"I said nothing about running away, my dear Commander Ellery,"
Canthan interrupted.
"But we should be gone from this particular room."
"With the book,"
Ellery reasoned.
"Not possible,"
Canthan informed her.
"Bah! I'll tear it out of the ground,"
said Athrogate, and he scrambled up on the railing and hopped down to the stairs.
"The book is protected," said Canthan. "It is but a conduit in any case. We'll not destroy it or claim it until the source of its power is no more."
"And that source is?"
Ulger Khan asked. And neither Canthan nor Jarlaxle missed the way the half-orc stiffened with the question.
"That is what we must discern,"
the wizard replied. Jarlaxle was unconvinced, for Canthan's gaze drifted over Arayan as he spoke. The drow knew the wizard had long ago discerned the source, as had Jarlaxle and Entreri. A glance at his assassin friend, the man's face rigid and cold and glaring hard Canthan's way, told Jarlaxle that Entreri was catching on as well, and that he wasn't very happy about the conclusions Canthan had obviously drawn.
"Then where do we start?"
Ellery asked.
"Down, I sense,"
said Canthan. Jarlaxle recognized that the man was bluffing, partially at least, though the drow wasn't quite certain of why. In truth, Jarlaxle wasn't so sure that Canthan's guess was off the mark. Certainly, part of the source for the construction was standing right beside him in the form of a half-orc woman. But that was a small part, Jarlaxle knew, as if Arayan had been the initial flare to send a gnomish fire rocket skyward before the main explosion filled the night sky with its bright burning embers. "The castle must have a king," the drow remarked. And he believed that, though he sensed clearly that Canthan believed it to be a queen instead, and one standing not so far away. It wasn't the time and place to confront the wizard openly, Jarlaxle realized,
The pounding on the door continued from above, and the volume of the scratching on the keep's main doors, just past Canthon and the book, led Jarlaxle to believe that scores of undead monstrosities had risen against them. The room was no sanctuary, and would soon enough become a crypt.
"Jarlaxle will peruse the book, and you will guard him,"
Canthon's magical sending echoed in Ellery's head.
"When we are long gone, you will do as you were trained to do, as you promised you could do."
Ellery's eyes widened, but she did well to hide her surprise. Another magical sending came to her.
"Our victory is easily achieved, and I know how to do it. But Jarlaxle will stand against my course. He sees personal gain here, whatever the cost to Damara. For our sake, and the sake of the land, the drow must be killed."
Ellery took the continuing words in stride, not surprised. She didn't quite understand what Canthon was talking about, of course. Easily achieved? Why would Jarlaxle not agree to something like that? It made no sense, but Ellery could not easily dismiss the source of the information and of her orders. Canthon had found her many years ago, and through his work she had gained greatly in rank and reputation. Her skill as a warrior had been honed through many years of training, but that added icing, the edge that allowed her to win when others could not, had been possible only through the work of Canthon and his associates. Though they were the enemies of the throne and her own relatives, Ellery knew that the relationship between the Crown of Damara and the Citadel of Assassins was complicated, and not quite as openly hostile and adversarial as onlookers might believe. Certainly, Ellery had quietly profited from her relationship with Canthon, and never had the wizard asked her to do anything that went against the crown. In her gut, however, she knew that there was something more going on than the wizard was telling her. Was Canthon seeking some personal gain himself? Was he using Ellery to settle a personal grudge he held with a dark elf?
"Now!"
Ellery jolted at the sharp intrusion, her gaze going to Canthon. He stood resolute, eyes narrow, lips thin. 100 questions popped into Ellery's mind, 100 demands she wanted to make of the wizard. How could she follow such an order against someone who had done nothing out of line along the expedition? Someone she had asked along and who had performed to that point so admirably? How could she do this to someone she had known as a lover? Though that had meant little to her. Looking at Canthon, Ellery realized how she could and why she would. The wizard terrified her, as did the band of cutthroats he represented. It all came clear to Commander Ellery at that moment, as she admitted to herself, for the first time, the truth of her involvement with the Citadel of Assassins and its wizard representative. She had spent years justifying her secret relationship with Canthon, telling herself that her personal gains and the way she could use them would benefit the kingdom. In Ellery's mind, for all that time, she thought herself in control of the relationship. She, the relative of Tramp and of both King Gareth and Lady Christine, would always do what was best for Damara and Greater Bloodstone. What did it matter if the dark tendrils of her choices delayed her from that moment of miracle her relatives all enviously awaited? That release of holy power that would show the world that she was beyond an ordinary warrior, that she was a paladin in the line of Gareth Dragonsbane. At that moment, though, the nakedness of her self-delusion and justification hit her hard. Perhaps Canthon was imparting truthful thoughts to her to justify her killing of the drow. Perhaps she tried to tell herself that Dark Elf Jarlaxle truly was an impediment to their necessary victory. Yes, that was it, the woman told herself. They all wanted to win, all wanted to survive. The death of Mariabrone had to mean something. The Jingian castle had to be defeated. Canthon knew that, and he apparently knew something about Jarlaxle that Ellery did not. Despite her newest rationalization, deep in her heart, Ellery suspected something else. Deep in her heart,
Ellery understood the truth of her relationship with Canthan and the Citadel of Assassins. But some things were better left buried deep. She had to trust him, not for his sake, but for hers. His eye patch tingled. Nothing specific came to him, but Jarlaxle understood that a magical intrusion, ascending or scrying, some unseen wave of magical energy, had just flitted by him. At first, the drow feared that the castle's king to whom he had referred might be looking in on them. But then, as Ellery remarked to him, "Do you believe you might be able to find some deeper insight into the magical tome? Something that Canthan has overlooked?" Jarlaxle came to understand that the source of the magic had been none other than his wizardly companion. The drow tried not to let his reaction to the question show him off guard when he lied. "I am sure that good Canthan's knowledge of the art is greater than my own." Ellery's eyes widened, and her nostrils flared, and the drow knew that he had surprised and worried her with his tentative refusal. He decided not to disappoint. "But I am drow, and have spent centuries in the Underdark where magic is not quite the same. Perhaps there is something I will recognize that Canthan has not." He looked at the wizard as he spoke, and Canthan gracefully bowed, stepped aside, and swept his arm to invite Jarlaxle to the book. There it was, as clear as it could be.
"We ain't got time for that,"
Athrogate growled, and the thought "on cue" came to the drow.
"True enough," Ellery played along. "Lead the others out, Athrogate," she ordered. "I will remain here to guard over Jarlaxle for as long as the situation allows."
Ellery nodded toward the book, but Jarlaxle motioned for her to go first. He passed by a confused-looking Entreri as he followed.
"Trouble,"
he managed to quietly whisper. Entreri made no motion to indicate he had heard anything, and he went out with Canthan, Athrogate, and the two half-orcs, moving down the tunnel Mariabrone had taken on his final journey. Jarlaxle stood before the open book, but did not begin perusing it. Rather, he watched the others head down the tunnel and stayed staring at the dark exit for some time. He felt and heard Ellery shifting behind him, moving nervously from foot to foot. Her focus was on him, he understood. She was hardly standing guard for him, over him, more likely. "Your friend Canthan believes he has figured out the riddle of the castle," the drow said. He turned to regard the woman, noting especially how her knuckles had whitened on the handle of her axe. "But he is wrong." Ellery's face screwed up with confusion.
"What has he said to you? How do you know this?"
"Because I know what he discerned from the book, as I have seen a tome similar to this one." Ellery stared at him hard, her hand wringing over the handle, and she chewed her lips, clearly uneasy with it all. "He told you to keep me here and kill me, not because he fears that I will prove an impediment to our escape or victory, but because Canthan fears that I will vie with him for the book and the secrets contained within. He is nothing if not opportunistic." Ellery rocked back and seemed as if she would stumble to the floor at Jarlaxle's obviously on-the-mark observation. Jarlaxle wasn't fool enough to think he could talk the woman out of her planned course of action, though, so he was not caught off guard when, just as he finished speaking, Ellery roared and came on. A dagger appeared in the drow's hand, and with a snap of his wrist it became a sword. He flipped it to his left just in time to parry Ellery's axe swipe, and he backstepped just fast enough to avoid the collision from her shield rush. A second dagger spilled forth from his bracer, and he threw it at her, slowing her progress long enough for him to extract a third from his enchanted bracer and snap his wrist again. When the initial assault played out and the two faced each other on even footing, the drow was holding a pair of slender longswords. Ellery launched a backhand slash and pressed forward as Jarlaxle rolled around the cut and thrust forth with his sword. Her shield took that one aside, and the clever underhand reversal of her cutting axe deflected the thrust.